Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Breaking news this afternoon, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh will be President-elect Joe Biden's nominee for U.S. Secretary of Labor. This ends weeks of speculation about whether Walsh would join the Biden administration or run for a third term as mayor of Boston. The news comes as Biden also prepares to name Rhode Island Governor Gina Raimondo as Commerce Secretary. For more, we're joined by WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Anthony, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Tiziana. Good to be here.
So tell us why Biden settled on Marty Walsh as labor secretary.
Well, it's interesting. He was believed to be a front runner. But, you know, as recently as yesterday, I was talking to someone close to Walsh and was told that the mayor is focused on combating COVID and he loves being the mayor of Boston. But all along, it was pretty clear that Walsh was a front runner. And by picking Walsh, Biden is making good on his promise to be what he called the most pro-union president ever. Walsh, of course, first elected mayor in 2013. He was a state rep. Before that, he was a union president. He was also head of the Boston Building Trades Council, which represented about 35,000 union construction workers before he was elected to the top job in City Hall. So he has a background for this, and he knows Biden, and Biden knows Walsh. So this is a pretty natural match.
So this just became real maybe an hour or so ago, Anthony. Are you hearing any reactions?
Yeah, we've heard some reaction, mainly from the labor community. I'm not sure if we've got this cut, but we heard from Frank Callahan, head of the Boston Building Trades Council. That's the council that Marty Walsh headed earlier. And do we have that cut, Tiziana?
I don't think we do, Anthony. Nope.
Well, I can give you a sense of what he said. He basically said, I think he's a fantastic pick. It's good to see someone who's an actual working person who has the background and the experience to do the job to represent working people in the federal government. So that is the view of labor, very positive at this point.
And Biden and Walsh are close, are they not?
Yeah, they are. They're really considered as friends, to be friends. In fact, Biden swore Walsh in to his second term. And their relationship goes back to the anniversary, I believe, of the Boston City Marathon bombing, where they really connected. So they've known each other for a long time, and they like each other a lot. So, again, a lot of reasons for Biden to choose Marty Walsh.
So this could open up a mayor's race for an open seat for the first time since 2013. If he's confirmed, he leaves City Hall. There's a year left on his second term. What happens?
Yeah, well, City Council President Kim Janey would step in as acting mayor. She could run for mayor herself. Two other city councilors, Michelle Wu and Andrea Campbell, have already announced their plans to run for mayor. So this all could result in giving Boston its first female mayor and its first mayor of color. So interesting moment of transition for the city of Boston.
And what kind of challenges would Marty Walsh face as the incoming Secretary of Labor in this moment, Anthony?
Yeah, I mean, it's a challenge and it's an opportunity. I mean, of course, Marty Walsh, if he becomes Secretary of Labor at this moment, we're in the midst of a pretty serious recession, tens of millions of Americans out of work. So the policies that the Biden administration enact around work and compensation and unemployment insurance and all that sort of thing are crucially important. It also would represent a real pivot from the Trump administration's very pro-business approach to a labor department that was run by someone who was known to be very sympathetic to unions and working Americans. So really interesting time to have someone like Marty Walsh become Secretary of Labor.
Well, I'm sure there's going to be more implications unfolding for both Walsh and Raimondo, and I know we'll continue to watch them. That's WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Anthony, I really appreciate it. Thanks.
Oh, my pleasure, Tiziana.
So let's turn now to Washington and the People's House, the U.S. Capitol, where yesterday afternoon, pandemonium struck. That is the sound of Trump supporting a mob approaching the Capitol. They're breaking through the metal barricades and overwhelming police. Now we hear them breaking glass windows and attempting to get inside the building. And that's the sound from inside the Capitol as they hammer at the exterior doors. And finally, the insurgents take the Capitol building. Let's turn now to someone who was there, Massachusetts Congressman Stephen Lynch. He's on the line. Congressman Lynch, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Tiziana. Good to join you.
I'm glad you're safe and well, Congressman. I can't imagine how stressful yesterday was. You were there. How are you today?
I'm good. Actually, we were pretty well protected after the threat became real. So we had police protection wherever we were. In the area that I live, right on Capitol Hill, we had a heavy police presence. And I thought that the National Guard and the FBI responded exceedingly well in clearing the chambers and also resetting that perimeter around the Capitol so we could go back to work and finish the job and do it safely. So it was tumultuous, but in the end, I think it's reassuring that Congress did its work and that we sent a message to the thugs and the people who did that, and also sent a message, I think, to the American people that they're democracy is alive and well, and that we are doing our best to make sure that every vote counts.
Congressman, you talked about sending messages there. How essential was it to finish the business of Congress last night?
That was job one. My fear was, and there was talk, especially among some of the Republicans in the Senate, that we should recess and that, you know, the tumult of the day made it incongruous to continue. And so, but it was Speaker Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. And actually, you know, Mitch McConnell agreed with the Democratic leaders on that point and said, you know, we have to get our job done. We have to show the American people that we are undaunted in our effort to, you know, conduct this constitutional duty of counting the electoral votes and certifying Joe Biden and Kamala Harris as president and vice president.
We're talking with Massachusetts Congressman Stephen Lynch. Congressman, so now we take this day and we go forward. You originally argued that Congress should take action to restrict the president's power until the transfer of authority and power on the 20th. This morning, you released a statement supporting use of the 25th Amendment, saying in part, quote, "It would be a clear message to other government agencies to resist any questionable or momentous instructions President Trump may give that would put the lives of Americans in peril or threaten our national security," end quote. Now, just this afternoon, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi publicly exhorted Vice President Pence to start 25th Amendment proceedings or that the president might face impeachment. Do you believe Pence and the cabinet will act on the 25th Amendment?
I'm doubtful, but we have to try everything, right? So if we're going to proceed along 25th Amendment lines, it requires the participation and the cooperation of the vice president. That's how this whole thing is set up. So we would need the vice president to initiate the petition. And also there's a way forward if we can get half of the 15, well, more than half, 8 out of the 15 sitting cabinet secretaries would have to support the Vice President Pence's petition on disability grounds based on the 25th Amendment. So I'm not sure that time allows for all of that, but I do think it's incredibly important to put a marker down here to say, you know, and that's why we are petitioning Mike Pence to do that, because we want to put a marker down that what President Trump did yesterday in directing that violent mob to interfere, to go to the Capitol and crash through the barricades and interfere with the constitutional process of certifying the president and vice president elects. So it was very important that we send that message. And so even though it may not ultimately be successful, I think we want to emphasize the fact that behavior was totally unacceptable. Not only was it unacceptable, but it demonstrated the president's unfitness to serve as our president. So we will give every effort to persuade the cabinet and Mike Pence to cooperate with us. If it does come to the House, we will support it vigorously. But again, it's going to have to pass in the Senate. And this is all with a ticking clock of 13 days. So it may be difficult. I also, you know, I've also signed on to the impeachment petition offered by Ilhan Omar. Now, that as well is a longer term process, but I think we've got to use whatever tools we have. I mean, I've already voted to impeach this president, and that was before the most recent egregious acts. But again, we've got to show how outrageous this conduct was, and we cannot let it stand.
Congressman, there's another question about accountability. Many, including Representative Tim Ryan of Ohio, are criticizing the Capitol Police response yesterday. It appeared there was a lack of planning before the protest, which was planned well in advance and featured a speech from the President of the United States. We've got videos that appear to show officers stepping aside, taking selfies with rioters as they entered the Capitol. What accountability needs to happen there?
So we need a full investigation. First of all, you know, I chair the Subcommittee on National Security, which, you know, covers the security of the Capitol and the White House and federal buildings. So Tim Ryan's absolutely right, and he's actually the chair of the Subcommittee on Appropriations in that area and on the budget. So we'll be working together. We saw the videos as well. But we need a full and thorough investigation on this, stem to stern. I know that the Biden administration has requested that already. So that will happen. The important thing right now is to preserve all the evidence. So the FBI was in the building last night. They had literally hundreds of officers doing crime scene investigation. Washington, D.C., and especially around the Capitol, is the most intensely permeated area for surveillance cameras and security cameras. So we will have miles and miles and miles of footage of what went on, beginning on the 4th right through to today, in terms of what happened. And we did see, films from iPhones that showed that there was a permissive posture taken by the Capitol Police, allowing those protesters, violent protesters, to come into the Capitol while Congress was in session in the House and the Senate. So
yeah.
I know that Speaker Pelosi has called for the resignation of the Capitol Police chief, and that won't be the last of this, but it certainly is a good start.
Before we let you go, Congressman, and I do appreciate your time, you've been close with Mayor Marty Walsh for a long time. You both have union backgrounds. I know you're aware that he is now President-elect Biden's pick for Labor Secretary. What's your reaction to that news?
I couldn't be more proud. I just got off the phone with him, as soon as the news was published. Marty Walsh and I strapped on the work boots together many years ago. He was a laborer, still is a laborer, and I'm an iron worker. We both still carry our union cards. But, in the construction industry, it's very up and down. It's very cyclical. So Marty Walsh and I, I'm proud to say, at times, during rough times, stood on the unemployment line together. And, how great is it that we have someone being nominated as Secretary of Labor who actually stood in an unemployment line in times like this, with so many people out of work because of the pandemic and people struggling? There's someone who who's put the work boots on, knows what it's like to struggle, stood on an unemployment line, knows what it's like to live on an unemployment check from week to week, and knows what it means to have a decent union health care and a decent pension and good work conditions. I just think, you know, sometimes the times find the person. And, I what we're going through here, Marty Walsh is just eminently qualified, not only from a skill set, but also from an emotional and compassion perspective. He knows what it is to struggle. He knows what our workers are facing out there. And I'm just so enormously proud. You know, I'm a union member, a member of the Boston Building Trades, like Mayor Walsh, a member of the Massachusetts Building Trades and the AFL-CIO. He and I have traveled together. We worked on the Gore campaign. We worked on the Kerry campaign, you know, different states, Pennsylvania, Iowa, West Virginia. He's a great and dear friend, and I'm just so happy for him and Laurie and for his mother Mary and their family. It's just a wonderful tribute to him, but also, you know, the labor community here in Massachusetts is enormously proud right now. This is a great moment, and we're just so proud of him, and we're thankful because President Biden and Marty Walsh are kindred souls, and they have been that way for many years. And I think it'll be easy for Marty to be in complete harmony with the administration's platform and their desires in the labor community and in the working life of Americans generally. So it's a great day in that respect.
That's wonderful. That's Massachusetts Congressman Stephen Lynch of South Boston. I know it's a busy, crazy time. Thank you for spending some time with Radio Boston today.
Happy to do that, Tiziana. Thank you. Bye-bye now.
When I was a kid, when big things happened, especially scary ones, we would find our way to the kitchen table, usually along with some friends and neighbors, and we would just talk it out. And that's what we want to do for the rest of the hour with you. You can pull up a chair, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, one of the truly wonderful things about living in Boston is that our friends and neighbors include people with exactly the wisdom and experience and perspective that the moment requires. And we have that today. Joining us right now is David Gergen. He has advised 4 U.S. presidents, Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. And he's also the founding director of the Center for Public Leadership at the Harvard Kennedy School, where he is a professor. David, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Tiziana. It's good to talk to you again.
It's great to have you. David, where's your head today? Can you give us a sense of sort of the journey in your own heart and mind over the last 24 hours?
Oh, it's been such a roller coaster, as hasn't it for all of us. And I think all of us are still trying to get our heads around just how important yesterday was. It was a horrifying day. I think it's also a day, though, that we looked into the abyss and saw how vulnerable our democracy can be. And my hope is that from this can come a new resolve. People on both sides of the aisle across the spectrum to put our democracy back together, to restart our civic culture, to rebuild our civic culture. The people we saw yesterday do not represent America. They were thugs. They were encouraged. They were incited by the President of the United States, no less. But there are many, many, many people who were not out there who would have gone just the other way and who really care about this country and saving the country. And I think that's with all due respect to Congressman Lynch, whom I greatly respect, I do not think our democracy is alive and well. I think we're in worse shape than we were 3 or 4 years ago. We've had a decline in civility, a decline in bipartisanship. The polarization has been growing long before Donald Trump got here. But who could have imagined that one man could be such a wrecking ball in our democracy? And I think that's what Donald Trump has become. I think it's a harder question about what to do next with Trump. There are growing calls, mostly from the left, that he ought to be thrown out of office either through the impeachment route or through the 25th Amendment. I think he's certainly proven that he's unfit for office. We need to send a very clear message that his role yesterday at least was seditious. And I think also had an insurrectionist quality. You know, I do think he violated the law and ought to be held responsible. How we get that done is not as easy as it looks. Time is both short and the divisions in the Congress are large. I think all options ought to be on the table. We ought to explore whether we can get there through the 25th Amendment. I'm somewhat doubtful that can be done. I'm doubtful, first of all, that you can get Pence to play ball as vice president. After all, Donald Trump, for better or for worse, still commands very large support within the Republican Party. 70-80% of Republicans think that Biden has been elected fraudulently. And Pence wants to run for president. So can you imagine him, you know, going out and taking the lead on the 25th Amendment? I doubt it. I just don't see how you get him to do that. Impeachment becomes another then option. And that has, I think, a bare impeachment without necessarily knocking him out of the office would be good. But I also think we ought to keep on the table the notion of a censure. Censure it's been tried twice against Trump. It didn't go anywhere. I think the votes would probably be there for a censure. And it's worth remembering that when Joe McCarthy was just this terrible scourge and he posed earlier dangers to our democracy back in the early 50s, that's what the Congress did to get him to destroy Joe McCarthy. They passed a vote of censure in both chambers.
And you felt like that worked.
I felt that worked, and I think we've got the time to get it done now.
David, I'm going to bring another voice and another friend and neighbor Please. Alongside you. We have Kelly Carter Jackson, who is assistant professor of Africana Studies at Wellesley College. Kelly Carter Jackson, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
So I think you heard most of what David just said. I think I'm just mm-hmm. going to start by giving you an opportunity to react to and build on that.
Yeah. I mean, so much of it I agree with, and I would say the only aspect that I don't is that, you know, I hear this idea that this is not America. And as a historian, I'm like, this is absolutely America. This is us, and we have to be honest about our history of white supremacy and our history of white terrorism and white violence. I think that, you know, it's a little too simplistic to put this all on Trump, given the fact that over 70 million people voted for Trump, supported Trump, wanted his leadership in play again. This will not go away when Trump goes away. We will have to reckon with who these people are. And I think it's too easy to look at these people and see them as sort of some fringe radical group. These are veterans. These are college students. These are soccer moms. These are members of the PTA. Like, there's a huge effort, I think, to want to distance these people away from the true America. But I think in so many ways, these people are representative of the white supremacy that has dominated American politics and economics and social political culture for so long. What I saw yesterday was completely disheartening, but what I also saw yesterday was not a shock. I think these people have been telling us for a very, very long time their intentions, their plans, what they desire to do. I think what was most disappointing was not just their actions, but the response by the police to their actions. So what I saw by law enforcement felt, you know, so duplicitous when you compare it to how Black Lives Matter protesters were assaulted by the police, shoved, tear gassed, beaten by the police, unarmed Black protesters. And yet, you know, you have people like at the Capitol and people who were at Michigan's state Capitol armed to the teeth with weapons of warfare, and they're treated as though they're harmless and they're treated as though they're not a threat. And that hypocrisy is something that many Black people can just not get their heads around.
So, Professor Kelly Carter Jackson, thanks for that. We've got Professor Kelly Carter Jackson and David Gergen, and joining you as we reflect on the events of the last 24 hours. I do want to go to the phones, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's hear from Scott in Somerville. Scott, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm curious to understand why it is that we're not, as a media and as a society, tagging these folks as exactly what they are, which is terrorists. And instead, we hear sort of a myriad of terms being used, rioters, thugs. This is terrorism, and I want to understand why it is that it seems hard to qualify and clarify this group as such. I'll take my call off the air.
Thank you, Scott. David Gergen, terrorism has a specific set of definitions. Do you agree with Scott's point? Certainly, we've had some conversation publicly over the last 24 hours about language and how important it is, labeling what's happening correctly in order to be truth-telling and deal with it correctly.
Well, I normally associate terrorism with people who have bombs or guns and attempt to gain power through force, and through violence. And I would have to tell you, as reprehensible as I found the crowd yesterday, it was in some ways, I had wondered we were going to have something much worse, whether there really would be a lot of people shooting at each other. And that did not happen. And I for that reason, I'm more comfortable with notions of insurrection, which is organizing violence against the state, which I think they did do. And also in addition, I think the word sedition applies, and that is organizing people to who will then go act on your organizing, your inspiration, your incitement. And I think sedition is clearly, appropriate here. So I do think the words matter. I'm very pleased that Kelly is here, and I really, really appreciate the fact she's had different views on some of these things. But I must say, Kelly, what I'm trying to argue is this is not America, what we saw yesterday. What I'm saying is there were people there who were demonstrating who I do not think are representative of America. We have deep-seated white supremacy. There's no question about that. We've had it's been forever America's original sin, and we continue to struggle with it today. But I think as representative as the people who took that hill yesterday were the people in Georgia who went and voted for those in those two elections that were supposed to go the other way. And they went up, and a lot of white folks voted for the black candidate. So to me, they're at least as representative as the white supremacists. And I would argue much more encouraging and hopeful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's the one thing that also really bummed me about yesterday is we had two historic wins in Georgia, yes, with the first black senator, first Jewish American senator. And I think that victory got overshadowed by this violence. We saw that over 50,000 black people, more black people, voted in this Georgia election than they did in the national election. And the organizing around getting these two people into office was enormous. And I think cause for celebration, but all of that got curbed by the attention that was placed at the Capitol. And I understand why. It's hard to sort of maintain these two narratives at the same time when we see this violence that's taking place. But I think the reason why we have, this black senator and this... Hello?
Please.
You're good. Keep going.
Oh, okay, sorry. I think the reason that we had this response, this violent response, was because of racial progress. And if we look throughout history, every time there is racial progress, whether it's symbolic or substantive, we have this backlash that happens in America. You can almost plan your calendar around it. And so that is what I think I'm talking about, the consistency of historical white backlash to racial progress. So yes, the racial progress is there and it should be applauded, absolutely. But I also think that it can't be discussed without also examining, this white violent reactionism and reaction and response.
I'm going to pick up a call here. We've got Noel on the line from Dorchester. Noel, go ahead.
Yes, so I was really sickened by this thing that transpired yesterday. It was very sickening. But what I want to know is, what was the difference between those rioters from yesterday and the Black Lives Movement?
Thanks for that call, Noel.
Night and day. Night and day. Absolutely night and day. I mean, we have the footage of all throughout the summer of the Black Lives Matter movements from June onward, some of the largest, or I dare to say the largest, protest movement in American history. Over 25 million people marched in the streets, unarmed and peaceful. And that was the majority of the narrative. What we saw yesterday at the Capitol
was not even close, could not be in compared within the same vicinity as the same sort of action that Black Lives protesters have taken. And I think had that crowd been made up of Black people, predominantly Black people or people of color, you would have seen a completely different response and a completely different outcome. You know, when I think back in December of 2018, climate activists staged a sit-in in Nancy Pelosi's office. Over 138 people were arrested. Yesterday, CNN reported only 13 people were arrested. 13. That's it.
So let's go to David Gergen on this too, Professor Carter Jackson. David, I think the thing I want to ask you about, I've been thinking about this, there was the dimension of the just shockingly disproportionate response between how law enforcement handled Black Lives Matter protests over the summer in the Capitol and what we saw yesterday. There was also the dismay that we heard from Congressman Lynch earlier about the lack of preparation and action taken to stop these Trump extremists as they tried to and successfully penetrated the Capitol building, a federal building. Have you seen this kind of, I don't know what the word is, scandal, dismay with the Capitol police before? Can you give us some context, or are we seeing something unprecedented here?
I think we're seeing something that's unprecedented, but it's also revealed something that Kelly is talking about that I do think is a continuation of trends we've seen in the past. What I do think is, had those protesters been Black, that there would have been a lot, the Capitol Police would have really assaulted them or hit them really, really hard. That one of the issues that arises from this, and Congressman Lynch suggested it earlier to Ziana, is I think we need to know, are the Capitol Police, is the Capitol Police a place where if you're a white supremacist, you can get a job? I don't know that, but I've been hearing that over the last 24 hours. I don't want to make any accusations, but I do think we need to know, because it was so true. It was shocking what we saw in these earlier protests by Black Lives Matter and others. When people were Black, and what we saw in D.C., let's go to that time with the Black Lives Matter demonstration, and President Trump came out of the White House and walked over with the Bible.
Lafayette Square. Sort of.
Look how those those peaceful protesters were treated by the by local police and guard and others. You know, they were mauled, and tear gas, and pepper spray, and all these other things were used when they were Black, or when there were whites allied with Blacks. But with this group that came out that Trump incited, you know, I've seen video of Capitol Police sort of opening the gates and letting people in.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
And you saw them as they walked through the rotunda. It was almost like people were on tour, you know, taking selfies and one thing and another. I mean, that was shocking. So I do think that there is a real issue that deserves to be investigated is what's the nature of the Capitol Police Force? Does it suffer from white supremacy or not? But also, how do we have more equal justice in the months and years ahead, so that if you're a protester, the color of your skin should not matter to how you're treated in a protest?
We have been engaged in a deep and thoughtful conversation this hour about the events that have unfolded in Washington, D.C. over the last 24 hours or so. We are lucky enough to have with us two guests, David Gergen, who has been an advisor to four presidents and is the founding director of the Center for Public Leadership at the Harvard Kennedy School, and Kelly Carter Jackson, an assistant professor of Africana Studies at Wellesley College. They're both still with us, and you have been continuing to call in. I think I'm going to go straight to the phones here and pick up another call at 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to start us off in this section. We've got Robert on the line from Randolph. Robert, go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. Yesterday, I think, also break the spell under Trump, because a lot of Republican, and this is a guy who could probably run again, and I just think that he doesn't realize yesterday, he break the breaking point that he does not realize he delayed this deliberate stand to his legacy. And what happened is when you stoke people for 4 years, and you use demographic, apocalyptic, these are the type of thing people just, and this is what exploded yesterday when he's trying to tell them to go and make a point. And these are the type of thing that when a guy told you that I can shoot somebody and I'm not going to get, and this is a person that was unfit for the presidency and he doesn't grow in the position. And that's what happened. And I think this is a lesson for the country to know that we have to elect people that can grow on the job, who's not going to gut it and oppose anybody that can say no to him and give clearance to anybody that he wants to.
Thank you, Robert. I appreciate that. And just to clarify, I think earlier you were making reference to the president who at one point during the campaign said that he could go out onto Fifth Avenue in New York and shoot somebody and he would not lose any support among his supporters. So David Gergen, Kelly Carter Jackson, I do want to turn us to the questions around culpability of President Donald Trump in what happened yesterday. At one level, there are going to be listeners screaming at me right as they hear me say that and say, what question? And there are others. We know there was a poll that came out today. I'm going to pull the data for you. This was a poll by YouGov Direct. The news came out today. They surveyed 1,450 registered voters and found that according to The Hill, among 52% of the Republicans, 52% found Joe Biden as being more culpable for what happened in D.C. yesterday than Donald Trump. So, Kelly Carter Jackson, what is the president's culpability?
Wow. I mean, that's just so disturbing. I think the way the news and the media has been presented to us, we have two totally different narratives, two completely separate worlds in terms of how people are getting their information and interpreting the information that they're getting. I think about culpability and I think, you know, I think that absolutely President Trump should be held accountable for his actions, for his words, for his misinformation campaign and how he has led people to believe things that are not true and constantly called the election a fraud. I believe there should be accountability with Republican elected officials who sided with him and also egged on these protesters to show up to the Capitol. I believe there's so many people that I think have been complicit in the horrendous actions that took place yesterday. But my fear is that in not holding people accountable, we will give license for these same instances to be committed again and again. And that's what I'm most concerned about, whether Trump is held liable or whether these protesters are actually found liable and charged of, insurrection, I think would be a really great start.
David Gergen, what is the accountability moment here? And I think we also need to include the fact that, for example, there are major media chains, for example, Fox today, saying that actually the people who penetrated the Capitol and were in the rotunda yesterday were in fact not pro-Trump people, but they're claiming they were Antifa or bad actors trying to make it look like it was Trump people. So where are the accountability moments here?
Such a good question. And Robert asked, I think, put his finger on something. Just a couple of points, Tiziana. First, I do think there is some accountability that's going to come from Trump himself. And that is, I think he... You know, he really wants to be president again. I think he destroyed whatever possibility he had to return to office. He still has a base out there. We don't know how big it is. We don't know whether some of it is eroding, but we do know it's strong. But I don't. I think that the overall feeling is he's unfit. And indeed, CNN was reporting last night someone very close to Trump saying he's out of his mind now. He's out of his mind. It's totally implausible to me that this man could ever be elected president again after what we've gone through. What I find more difficult, Tiziana, and I don't know the answer to this, but there's a part of all of us who have been horrified by yesterday's events and are angry about it to want to see, a real reckoning and to put down these people who are giving us so much disinformation, to find ways to, you know, we want some accountability against all these people. At the same time, there's a question: for the good of the country, do we, can Joe Biden ever stitch things back together? Can we heal as a people if we're going to spend the next 2 or 3 years, relitigating what happened yesterday and punishing people who were not at the center of it, but were part of it? I don't know the answer to that question. Do we put ourselves back together by getting together and talking and putting, you know, the Mandela way, which would be, have a truth and reconciliation kind of approach? Or do we really go hard-nosed against each other? I don't know. But I do think that's a question that's going to be really important for the Biden presidency, because his nature is going to be to try to make amends, to try to hold out a peace offering. And there are a lot of people in the country who are not ready to make peace. And they'll look at that 52% number. And as Kelly did, I blanched when I heard that. I was like, what? 52% think Biden is more culpable than Trump? That's just amazing to me.
Yeah. I'm going to go back to the phones here, 800-423-8255. We have Roland on the line from Boxford. Roland, go ahead.
Yeah, so what I'm going to say first, I appreciate your example, and
Roland, I'm so sorry, but your sound quality is so weak that we actually can't understand what you're saying. We'll see if the team can get you back.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Roland, I'm going to take you offline and let the team sort that out, thanks, and then we'll try to come back to you. So let's pick up Ralph in Arlington for now. Ralph, go ahead.
I have a couple of points.
If you could just pick your most important, please, just your most important point, please, because we're short on time.
Okay, the woman professor from Wellesley stated that there were only 13 arrests at the U.S. Capitol. That's not correct. NPR has repeatedly said that there were at least 50 arrests.
Ralph, thanks for that. So here's what we've got, folks. Here's what we've got. According to WUSA Channel 9, which is a D.C.-based news organization, 69 people were arrested by the D.C. police. The U.S. Capitol Police made 13 arrests, which I think is the story, the number that you, Professor Kelly Carter-Jackson, was using. And NPR has said 80 arrests made by Thursday morning. So just to be, my job as a journalist is to make sure we give our listeners the correct information. So there it is. Helpful. Now you can go ahead and finish your point, Ralph.
Okay. Well, another thing is that in the Capitol, I watched an hour of footage, mostly from the outside, like all these hundreds of people on the steps and such. And also some from inside, and I did not see any guns. I'm not saying none of them had guns, but I was looking for them. And, you know, I know that they did in Michigan, but in D.C., guns are not allowed to be carried openly, and I didn't see any. So
thanks for that, Ralph. Thanks for that. Yep. And I do want to point out, and Professor Carter-Jackson, I'm going to come back to you in a second to respond to Ralph. I do also want to say there were also reports of pipe bombs, so other types of weapons. Yeah. And we did see footage that appeared to have some of the rioters spraying what appeared to be tear gas or pepper spray at law enforcement. Again, just trying to provide clarity. Mm-hmm. Things are moving fast. We're still sorting out what happened yesterday. Professor Kelly Carter-Jackson.
Thank you for clarifying that. I really appreciate that. I also think that we have to be careful that violence is not encapsulated in firearms. And so what we saw yesterday, regardless of whether we saw firearms or not, were clear instances of people pushing the police, shoving the police, trying to grab batons and shields from their hand. I still can't sort of process like how I watched the brazen audacity of the mob confronting the police without fear. I just don't think this could happen in any other circumstance with any other group of people. And I think we have to be careful not to give people passes over what we consider force versus what we consider violent. What we saw yesterday was completely unacceptable, wholesale. Completely unacceptable. And in no way did they demonstrate peaceful protest.
So I'm going to pick up one more call here. We've got Mark in Harwichport. Mark, if you could be brief, you are up.
Okay.
Go ahead, Mark.
Okay, I would like to recall, or I would like to keep Pence, McConnell, and Kevin Kevin McCarthy tied into this. I recall in 1974, Barry Goldwater, who was an extreme conservative and very much backed President Nixon, he finally said, I have heard one too many lies from President Nixon. He must get his butt out of the White House today. And with that, he walked to the White House with the Republican leaders of the House and the Senate,
yep,
talked to Nixon and said, Nixon, you have to resign.
Mark, thank you. I am so sorry to cut you short, but we have limited time, and I want to give David Gergen, who was an advisor to President Nixon and three other presidents, last word on this. David Gergen.
Mark has got his history right. Maybe some of the details are a little off, but the thrust of what he is saying is exactly right. Barry Goldwater did lead a Republican delegation and told President Nixon, you don't have the votes. You don't have the votes in the House or the Senate. You're going to get kicked out. Why don't you go now? And that's why Nixon left. Would a similar delegation from this current Republican Party do that with Trump? I sincerely doubt it. We're not hearing the Republicans yet in their reaction to all of this, but I think we're still in a very poisonous place in our politics. Our democracy is not alive and well. Democracy, as we're learning, has to be secured by every new generation, and it's going to be our responsibility while we're still here on this earth to try to restore this, our democracy, and try to restore a sense of civility and respect within our country for people who disagree with us.
Kelly Carter Jackson, I'm just feeling the weight of what David Gergen just said. In our last, I don't know, half a minute or so, what's the first step to restoring that democracy in your mind?
First of all, I can't agree more with what David just said, but I think the first step is honesty. Honesty. We have to tell the truth. We have to tell the truth, and we have to believe the truth when we see it. And I think that is the hardest thing to get consensus around right now, is who is culpable and what happened and the double standard of how people are treated by the police. This is something we have to get agreement around. Otherwise, you know, we can expect to see these things happen again.
Well, I could not be more grateful to the two of you. We are so lucky to have friends and neighbors and experts like the two of you help us sort things out on a day like this. You just heard Kelly Carter Jackson, who is an assistant professor of Africana Studies at Wellesley College, and you heard David Gergen, advisor to four U.S. presidents. He's also the founding director of the Center for Public Leadership at the Harvard Kennedy School, where he's a professor. Thank you to both of you for today.
Thanks, Suzanne. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you, David.